That lines, Tehran criticizes Germany for inciting terrorism and hate speech in Iran while considering the fight against the same phenomena as the priority for its territory. A prominent Sunni cleric is found dead in Iran's southeastern province of Sistan and Balochistan a day after he was kidnapped by Takfiri terrorists. Palestinians attend the funeral procession of a teenager who was killed during clashes with Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank on Thursday. Hello and welcome everybody. It's our top story for this half hour. Iran has rejected the West's criticism of its response to a rioting in the country, saying that it's a clear international responsibility for any government to fight terrorism, violence, and hate speech. Earlier we discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's have a look. On this segment of the program, Iran says fighting terrorism, violence, and hate speech is a clear international responsibility amid the Western criticism of its response to the riots in the country. The Iranian foreign minister singled out Germany's, quote, hypocritical and duplicitous stance on the unrest in Iran. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Berlin considers such scourges as red lines for itself, but incites the same sinister phenomena in Iran and denounces Tehran's legitimate campaign against them. Germany has condemned Iran and summoned the Iranian ambassador. The UK and Canada have also slapped fresh sanctions on Iran, while the EU is also reportedly set to impose more bans on the country. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Mr. Said Mohsen Abbas, who's joining us from the British capital, London. We also have author and journalist Robert Fantina, who's joining us from Kitchener, Ontario. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Abbas in London, and let's jump right in. I want to get your thoughts on the recent comments coming from the Iranian foreign minister.
Well, it's a very natural reaction to a very hypocritical policy and stance taken up by the likes of Germany, Britain, and the rest of the Anglo-Zionist Empire. The reality is that this is a premeditated set of acts, riots, the terrorism, the synchronized propaganda, the media propaganda that's gone with it. You know, these things don't just happen by accident. You'd have to be rather naive to the extreme to think that there wasn't some kind of preemptive coordination that is linking this, you know, this entire set of scenarios. And Germany, with its intelligence services and knowing full well what its relations are with the Americans, is fully aware of what goes on in terms of regime change policies that the Americans dictate. And Germany, being one of the most prominent members of NATO, one of the most prominent members in the EU, has its financial interests tied so closely to the Americans that they're willing to even allow the demise of Europe within this whole war in Ukraine that you see, and the whole energy crisis that's resulted. So Germany and its leaders are, first of all, acting criminally towards their own people, their own citizens. They're enacting policies which are detrimental to their own German folk. But when it comes to terror and the war on terror, of course, Germany is one of those flag wavers in terms of condemning ISIS and condemning all the kind of so-called Islamic terrorism. And they've got huge new terrorism laws all in place to stop such terror and such rioting. And they will come down like a ton of bricks on anybody who even dreams of doing such an action in Germany. And for them to, of course, sanction it, to ignore all of the evidence that exists on the ground, to ignore the fact that ISIS have been involved, to ignore the fact that the provinces are getting full arms supply and are being coordinated to try and create insurrections, and with this, especially their awareness of the fact that the MKO is serviced in Albania, and such forces are the ones that are operating on the ground along with other terrorist organizations, Jundala. To ignore all that is criminal, to be honest, on the German part. But of course, they're having to toe the American line on maximum pressure. And this is all about bringing Iran to its knees by making it afraid that it can't even handle its own domestic situation, that it must capitulate on issues like JCPOA and the nuclear deal, capitulate on its regional defense policies, capitulate, of course, on their ballistic missile programs, i.e. everything to do with defending Iran, everything to do with maintaining its sovereignty and independence must be given away in order for the Germans and the Americans and the UK to relax these kinds of absolutely abominable acts of which are against the UN Charter. They're blatantly, flagrantly trying to instigate regime change or government change, and that is by international law. It's absolutely preposterous. It's against any kind of human civilizational action. If Iran was to even try to do anything like that within any of these nations of Germany, Britain, and whatnot, they would immediately take Iran to some international courts and try to bring even more of their sanctions down on them. Iran doesn't do such things, yet it's regarded almost as an exceptionalism for Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-Western Zionist powers to do whatever they want, and that's what's happening here.
Robert Fantina, would you like to add anything to what Mr. Mohsen Abbas, our guest in London, just said? Also, do you agree with his assessment that this is in line with the maximum pressure campaign and maximum pressure policy against Iran?
Yes, I do agree. The United States wants regime change in Iran and will seize on anything to try to force that, including issuing sanctions, violating the JCPOA, and so on. I also want to comment on the hypocrisy that the Iranian foreign minister so correctly pointed out. Germany is criticizing Iran's policies, and yet it says nothing about Israel's brutal, ongoing, for decades, policies against the Palestinians. The killings of the Palestinians, the destruction of their homes, the destruction of their economy. Germany has full diplomatic relations with Israel and never says a word about that, and now when there's some internal unrest in Iran, it is immediately condemning the Iranian government. The same with Canada. Canada needs to get its act cleaned up regarding its treatment of indigenous people within our borders. I'm in Canada. Before it starts criticizing anybody else for any alleged or genuine human rights violations, Canada is committing them on a regular basis against indigenous people in Canada, and so is in no position to denounce any other country's behaviors until it does it about its own. This hypocrisy we see in certainly the United States, where people of color are imprisoned at a much higher rate, astronomically higher rate than whites, where racism is institutionalized, and yet the United States will criticize what's happening in Iran, what the Iranian government is doing. It is all, as your other commentator mentioned, it's all to bring about regime change so that a government that's compliant to U.S. demands, that will follow U.S. dictates, will be installed in Iran. That is not what the Iranian people want. And the blatant efforts of these other countries to bring that about are against in violation of international law, again, as your other commentator mentioned, and are unlikely to succeed because the Iranian people do not want another puppet government whose strings are pulled by the U.S.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Said Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, joining us from the British capital, London, author and journalist Robert Fantina, speaking to us from Kitchener, Ontario. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of News Arriba. Do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come. Also, a prominent Sunni cleric, Molavi Abdul Wahid Righi, has been found dead in Iran's southeastern Sistan and Balochistan province today after he was kidnapped by Takfiri terrorists. Provincial officials say that Righi was abducted at noon on Thursday after leaving a mosque in the city of Khosh. Officials say they have opened an investigation into the killing. The cleric had previously said that he was threatened by groups hostile toward the Islamic Republic. He made the remark during a meeting with a delegation sent to the province by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Sistan and Balochistan and some other provinces have been the scene of foreign-backed unrest following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Palestinians hold a funeral procession for a teenager killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. 16-year-old Deya Arhimi was killed in a village northwest of Ramallah on Thursday. Three Palestinians were also killed and several others injured on the same day during an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Friday was declared a day of public mourning in Jenin. Israeli forces have been escalating deadly attacks against Palestinians, killing some 150 this year alone across the West Bank. The resistance movement Hamas has reacted defiantly to the surge in Israeli violence. It says the regime will only make Palestinians more resolute in their resistance. Our West Bank correspondent Mona Kandil tells us more about how Palestinian resistance groups have reacted to the Israeli killing of their young compatriot.
Palestinian resistance groups have stressed that their option to resist or the option to resist is the only option left to them to respond to the ongoing Israeli crimes and aggression. Palestinian resistance groups have made it clear that the more Israeli military would be killing Palestinians in cold blood and even targeting Palestinian fighters, this would make Palestinians more resolved to continue the resistance, to fight the Israeli forces, and to stand against the illegal Israeli policies. Palestinians have been left alone. There are only condemnations from the international community, the European Union, but at the same time, Palestinians are being killed in cold blood without anything left to them. The Israelis don't want for the Palestinians to resist. They want to raid Palestinian areas and kill people, destroy their homes, arrest people from all walks of life, and at the same time, they don't want them to resist or to react to these crimes.
The Al-Quds International Institute has held a conference in the besieged Gaza Strip to shed more light on Israeli violations in Al-Quds and ways to confront the Judaization of the Holy City. Palestinians stress that Al-Quds will always remain the capital of Palestine despite the U.S. and Israeli plots to change its status. Our correspondent in Gaza, Asher Shannon, has this report.
A conference has been held in the Gaza Strip to support Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It is dubbed Judaization of Al-Quds and ways to confront it. Experts, academics, and senior Palestinian officials have attended the conference. They have discussed ways to tackle the growing Israeli violence against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This, as Israeli officials have been trying to Judaize the holy Muslim city of Al-Quds in the past by demolishing Palestinian homes and building illegal Jewish settlements.
We are holding this conference to support Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa Mosque and to reaffirm the Islamic identity of Al-Quds. Holding this event this year is of great significance amid the escalation of Zionist aggressions against Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians consider Al-Quds as the capital of their future state. Speaking to Press TV, the Hamas movement asserted the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Quds and refuted all Israeli claims to the holy city.
Quds was never a state or a capital of a state for the Jews. All the history indicated that it was part of Palestine, and Palestine was and still is a part of the Arabic countries, which is a part of the Islamic world.
Occupied by Israeli regime forces 55 years ago, Al-Quds has been at the core of the Palestinian struggle for freedom. Those who attended the conference slammed the normalization of ties between some Arab countries and the Israeli regime.
I think that as Al-Quds is not just only for Palestinians, it's for Arabs and for Islamic nations. So why the Arabs now normalize the relation with Israel, and they do all their efforts against Palestinians.
In its final communique, the conference stressed the importance of protecting Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque against all Israeli plots.
Observers say the international community has failed to help Palestinians in Al-Quds and has been turning a blind eye to violations committed by the Israeli regime against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Russian president has threatened to cut oil production in response to the Western price cap on the country's crude exports.
We will even maybe consider a possible, I'm not saying now that this is a definitive decision, but we will think about a possible reduction in production if necessary.
Putin was speaking at a news conference following a regional summit in Kyrgyzstan. He vowed that Moscow would announce retaliatory steps in the next few days. The Russian leader also slammed the price cap as a, quote, stupid decision, warning that the move is harmful to global energy markets. However, he stressed that the $60 price limit on Russia's seaborne oil isn't affecting his country. The restrictions are aimed at reducing Russia's ability to finance the war in Ukraine. Kiev has also reacted to the decision by calling the move ineffective and a weak position by its allies. Greg Simons is a researcher at the Sweden-based Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies. He says the EU's price cap decision will come back to haunt the bloc itself.
The reality is they know it's going to bite them. I mean, they've been talking about how the US is deindustrializing Europe, which it is through these acts of stupidity, which these European bureaucrats are willingly doing for Washington. So, I mean, this is just a dog biting its own tail. And, I mean, it's going to go nowhere good. And, I mean, this has been proven. They know that their industry is going to go down. They know there's going to be a shortage of fuel. They know that the prices are going to go up. And that the rest of the world, beyond this little Eurocentric vision and the different vassal states which belong to this US configuration of this Western-centric world, do not agree with them.
Well, the European Union is to add more than $2 billion to a fund used to help arm Ukraine, but this could face delays amid differences with Hungary. EU diplomats say preliminary agreement has been struck among the 27 member bloc to bolster the European peace facility. The fund has already committed over 3 billion euros to cover the cost of weaponry for Kiev. The deal was set to be signed on Monday, but a standoff with Hungary over its own frozen EU funds could see Budapest delay approval. The EU has frozen Hungarian funds over the country's opposition to the bloc's sanctions on Russia and its refusal to support the war in Ukraine. Hungary argues that the EU is playing a dangerous game by providing Ukraine with destructive weapons, training Ukrainian soldiers, and imposing sanctions on Russian energy. British postal workers begin the first of several strikes in December. They join other walkouts over pay, signaling major holiday disruptions. Thousands of Royal Mail postal workers are walking off the job, demanding higher salaries to keep up with Britain's soaring inflation. The union representing the workers says that Royal Mail increased salaries by 2%, but that was not enough to cope with the rising costs of living. The strike is part of a spiraling number of industrial actions across numerous sectors, including rail workers, ambulance drivers, and airport staff. The government is now preparing to enlist the army to cover ambulances and border security ahead of a wave of strikes this month. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has called the union leaders unreasonable and warned of of new laws that would curb the right to strikes.
You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has repeated his allegations about fraud in the 2020 presidential election and called for suspension of America's Constitution. The Biden White House has strongly criticized Donald Trump for calling for the termination of the Constitution. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. CNN has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has called for the termination of the U.S. Constitution's rules regarding elections to overturn the results of the disputed 2020 presidential election, following the emergence of evidence that social media sided with the Washington establishment to suppress negative reports about Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, ahead of the election. Donald Trump said on Saturday, 3rd of December, the founding fathers of the United States did not want fraudulent elections in the country. Elon Musk released what he called the Twitter files on Friday, 2nd of December, delving into the company's decision to block the Hunter Biden laptop story. The post focused on the controversy surrounding Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and Twitter's reaction limiting the spread of posts about it. It was billed as a bombshell that exposed how Twitter engaged in free speech suppression in the critical run-up to the 2020 presidential election. Trump said in a Truth Social post, "A massive fraud of this type and magnitude allows for termination of all rules, regulations, and articles, even those found in the Constitution. Our great founders did not want and would not condone false and fraudulent elections." Donald Trump said the revelations show massive and widespread fraud and deception from big tech, the Democratic National Committee, and the Democratic Party, asking if the 2020 presidential election results should be thrown out and he should be declared the winner, or if a new election should be held. Trump believes that the election was rigged by the U.S. establishment in favor of Joe Biden. He has said that the 2020 presidential election was the greatest election hoax in history. He previously accused Twitter and Facebook of helping Joe Biden to win the election. Pulitzer Prize-winning American investigative journalist Glenn Greenwald has revealed that an axis of the CIA, big technology firms, and the Democratic National Committee, allied wing of the corporate media, spread an absolute lie in the weeks before the 2020 presidential election to help Joe Biden win the vote. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. The Biden White House rebuked Donald Trump after the former president said the U.S. Constitution should be terminated over his claim that the 2020 election was stolen. Andrew Bates, a White House spokesperson, said, "Attacking the Constitution and all it stands for is anathema to the soul of our nation and should be universally condemned." Andrew Bates called the Constitution a sacrosanct document saying you cannot only love America when you win. Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden in 2020 by more than 7 million votes and by 306 to 232 in the Electoral College count, a result he called a landslide when it was in his favor in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump continues to say that Joe Biden won key states through electoral fraud, a claim that fueled the deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021. 9 deaths have been linked to the riot in the Capitol building, including law enforcement suicides. More than 950 people have been charged. Recently, 2 members of the far-right Oath Keepers militia were convicted of seditious conspiracy. Other members of far-right pro-Trump groups face similar charges. Donald Trump was banned from Facebook and Twitter after a Capitol attack. He has not yet returned to the latter, despite his new owner, Elon Musk, saying he's free to do so. Donald Trump is the only declared candidate for a Republican nomination in 2024, but he has faced increasing criticism from within the Republican ranks and Republican supporting media since midterm elections in which many of his endorsed candidates were defeated, including election deniers in battleground states. Republicans took the House of Representatives, but only by a narrow margin, and failed to retake the U.S. Senate. On Saturday, 3rd of December, Donald Trump also criticized the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and all of the weak Republicans who couldn't get the presidential election of 2020 approved and out of the way fast enough. Even after the Capitol riot, 147 Republicans objected to results in key states. Senior Republicans have also criticized Donald Trump over his decision to have dinner at his home in Florida with Nick Fuentes, a known white supremacist and anti-Semite. The website Politico has also covered the same story. Representative Liz Cheney, Republican of Wyoming, called former President Donald Trump an enemy of the Constitution on Sunday, 4th of December, after Trump suggested considering terminating the Constitution on Saturday, 3rd of December, the most overt condemnation in the GOP of Donald Trump's words. Liz Cheney tweeted, "No honest person can now deny that Trump is an enemy of the Constitution." Other Republicans joined Cheney in being critical of the idea of the Constitution being set aside, but they declined to say whether they'd vote for Donald Trump again after their statement. Representative Mike Turner, a Republican from Ohio, said, "It is certainly not consistent with the oath that we all take. I vehemently disagree with the statement from Donald Trump that Donald Trump has made." But Turner, speaking to host Margaret Brennan on CBS's Face the Nation program, declined to say Donald Trump's remarks were disqualifying when it came to his presidential candidacy. Turner said, "There is a political process that has to go forward." On Saturday, 3rd of December, Brian Schatz, a Democratic U.S. senator from Hawaii, pointed to such hard political reality, saying, "Trump just called for the suspension of the Constitution, and this is the final straw for zero Republicans, especially the ones who call themselves constitutional conservatives." One such conservative is Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader battling to become House Speaker. Not long before Donald Trump said the Constitution should be terminated, Kevin McCarthy said that when his party took control in January, it would demonstrate its constitutional bona fides by reading every single word of the hallowed document on the floor of the House. On Sunday, 4th of December, Hakeem Jeffries, the newly elected Democratic leader in the House, told ABC's This Week program Trump had made a strange statement, but the Republicans are going to have to work out their issues with the former president and decide whether they're going to break from him and return to some semblance of reasonableness or continue to lean in to extremism, not just of Donald Trump, but of Trumpism. On the same show, Dave Joyce of Ohio, chair of the Moderate Republican Governance Group, refused five opportunities to say he would not vote for Donald Trump if he was the nominee in 2024. John Bolton, George W. Bush's United Nations ambassador, who became Donald Trump's third national security advisor, said, "No American conservative can agree with Donald Trump's call to suspend the Constitution because the results of the 2020 election. And all real conservatives must oppose his 2024 campaign for president." We'll be right back.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and since we're commemorating the martyrdom anniversary of Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, here is a statement to ponder upon her God-given merits by her father, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Mary, the mother of Jesus, was the noblest lady of the world of her time. But my daughter Fatima is the noblest ever lady of all times, from the beginning until the end.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, believing in God. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of believing in God in the Islamic lifestyle. When we say we need to believe in God in the Islamic lifestyle, it means that we need to be a monotheist, believe in one God or one Allah who has created us. Now, the beliefs that we need to have is that we must believe that He is the creator of all, and He has created us for His worshiping. That's the first thing. The second thing that comes under the topic of believing in God is that we must believe, and we must believe that He has created everything with a rule or a principle. And the principle is the principle of cause and effect, the rule of cause and effect. He has created everything under the rule of cause and effect. And whatever we see in this world, it is because of the rule of cause and effect that is there. There is something which is specific for us, which has been decided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. For example, the time we will be born, the time we die. He knows about the day of judgment. We don't know about that. When will it happen? But the thing is that whatever we are doing in this world, it is following the rule of cause and effect. And this is important, that if we see anything happening, we should not put this on God. You know, there are some people, the Muslims and non-Muslims, like, who believe in God in some case, like, in somehow they believe in any God. Whenever something happens, they put that on the God, that, oh God, why you have done so with me? But they do not think about what they were doing and what were the consequences. And if they ponder on it, they find the actual reason behind that. Therefore, it is necessary to make right our beliefs towards God. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of believing in God, and we said that in our daily life, sometimes we do something and some bad things happens to us, maybe the consequences that we see, and then later we put that on God, that, oh God, you have done this, why you did this to me? And whereas the Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created the world on the rule of cause and effect. The things that we are seeing in our life are because it is the effect of a cause, and we don't realize the things that we are doing, the actions that we are performing, the way we are dealing with the people. And therefore, we blame God. We should avoid this, because God is the creator. He has created us for good. He does goodness to us. And everything which is evil that is happening to us in our life, it is because of our own deeds. In order to have a real Islamic lifestyle, we need to have the right belief on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The other important thing is that when we say we need to believe in God, we must trust Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, which is known as tawakkul ala Allah in the Quranic text. In the Arabic form, they say tawakkul ala Allah. So this tawakkul, or trusting Allah, is that I perform whatever is in my hands, I do my best, but I leave the results on God, and God will help. So I must try first and then leave the results in the hands of God. So this is tawakkul. Other than that, if I can quickly talk about the evil, the concept of evil, there is no evil in the world. The evil is basically, it is in relation to something. For example, if snake has a poison, this poison is good for the snake, but this is in relation to human beings, it is not good. For example, if there is anything that we think it is evil, that is good for that thing itself. For example, raining itself is good for the earth, for the environment, but maybe for some people, because it causes flood, it is not good. But for the environment, for the world, to secure the nature, it is good. Therefore, we must believe in God the way we should, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's woodblocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of thick sheets of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. The ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
A lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic bears from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 bears of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella bears, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bears' living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mundo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes. Thousands of people crowd into the British city of Norwich to watch a 2-kilometer-long string of dominoes topple, while winding through town. Some 7,500 breeze blocks were set up for the event. The dominoes slinked through street buildings, windows, and even climbed up stairs and trees. The toppling lasted 30 minutes. The moving sculpture was installed across the city with the help of some 200 volunteers. The artistic director said the work was chosen partly because it was a spectacle and both disrupted the city and engaged its people.
There's a sense of anticipation that goes with the work. You would have seen people around town at the moment. Everybody's asking, what's going on? And then when they realise what it is, then there's this sense of, oh, and when are you going to knock it over? So that it's a sculpture also that gets destroyed in many ways, and that's really part of the work as well. I mean, I like to think about it as a child almost playing with the city. You know, they're setting everything up, and we all know they're going to knock it down at some point, and that's fun.
Daniel Bryant said he was excited about the project because it looked like a child had taken over the city with the joy of knocking down dominoes. The cascading dominoes ran through two cities, eventually ending at the site of Norfolk and Norwich Festival of Arts. The organizers say the goal of the installation was to bring unity to the community. Chilean paleontologists unearthed a rare, fully intact fossil of what is known as a sea dragon discovered from a melting glacier deep in Patagonia.
It is the first complete and excavated ichthyosaur that has been found in Chile. It also corresponds to one of the most complete fossils ever found on the planet for the Cretaceous period. It is the only pregnant ichthyosaur that's been found on the planet from the era between 129 and 139 million years ago. So it's incredibly important.
The 4-meter-long fossil is nicknamed Fiona and swam the seas some 250 million years ago. Scientists say this specimen will help them understand this species and its embryonic development. The expedition lasted over a month because of the remote nature of the find in the Patagonian glaciers. Paleontologists had to make a 10-hour hike just to get to the site. They also had to camp in extreme weather conditions while maneuvering tricky, rocky surfaces. But collecting and transporting the fossil was a whole other story.
As we went down excavating, weakening the rock, we realized the skeleton was mostly complete, so much that the bones were pushed inwards and we had to make 5 blocks of approximately 200 kilos each to move it.
The blocks were then airlifted to the Rio Seco Natural History Museum in southern Chile to be prepared for exhibition. The fossil was first discovered by Ruth Pedro more than a decade ago, but because of the site's harsh terrain, its extraction was a complex challenge. Scientists also discovered over 20 other specimens of the same species during the expedition, bringing the total found in the glacier area to 100.
Stopping by and listening to street musicians usually changes our mood for the rest of the day. The experience would be different if one lies under the instrument while it is being played. And that's exactly what a pianist in America has done. Colin Huggins, a busker, wheels his grand piano more than a half a mile from a mini storage to New York's Washington Square Park. He lets people lie down under the instrument and feel the vibrations from the claviers in their bodies. Colin says he wants to help people recover emotionally from the intense disconnect they had faced during COVID lockdowns.
I've always wanted to accommodate feelings in the best way possible, and I wanted to do it with music, and this is the best way I figure out how to do it. Maybe someday I'll figure out a way to do it even better, and I won't need to push this piano here, but as of now, this is the best I've got.
New York was one of the hardest hit cities by COVID in the U.S. Like other places, the major city imposed lockdowns and tough curbs to contain the virus. Despite that, Colin continued playing on the streets, frequently to an audience of zero. He says he strongly believes that everything will be okay.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Fires and droughts in the western states of the United States are getting worse, and they are combining with industrial sources to threaten air quality and people's health. In this regard, we have provided an exclusive article written by the staff of the scientific publication Nature. Stay tuned for more. In September 2020, the skies in Oregon turned crimson as dozens of wildfires scorched forest in Cascade Mountains. In just 3 days, the blazes engulfed nearly 4,000 square kilometers, more than had burnt in Oregon during the previous 36 years combined. For 2 weeks, the acrid air held residents hostage in their homes. The Oregon Health Authority documented a 38% increase in respiratory-related visits to hospital emergency departments during September 2020 compared with the previous month. It was the worst 2-week period they had ever experienced for air pollution anywhere, including India, China, and Bangladesh, says Perry Histad at Oregon State University in Corvallis, who studies health impacts of the worst air pollution worldwide. One stark sign of the dangers could be seen in the Air Quality Index, AQI, a measure of particulate matter pollution, PM, ozone, carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, and nitrogen dioxide. The US AQI scale runs from 0 to 500, and values more than 300 are considered hazardous to everybody. For 2 weeks in mid-September, during the most intense burning across Washington State, Oregon, and California, the AQI was at 300 and above. The air monitors closest to the fires were shut off or knocked out. On the worst day, southeast of Salem, Oregon, the AQI surged past the scale's limit. Extrapolations by the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality estimate that it would have reached 642. There are AQI values that were unheard of in the region until the past 5 years, says Dan Jeff, an atmospheric chemist at the University of Washington in Seattle. Fine particulate pollution reached levels between 4 and 11 times the national ambient air quality standards limit set by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, and it didn't stay in the West. The pollution traveled all the way to New England on the U.S. East Coast. Air quality in the western United States has grown markedly worse in the past decade, owing largely to wildfires that are getting bigger and more frequent with the warming climate. In 2020, more than 4 million hectares burned in the United States, the second highest amount since national records began in 1983. During the summer 2020, western wildfires accounted for nearly one quarter of the PM from particles less than 2.5 micrometers in diameter in the continuous United States. The problem is getting worse across the world. Globally, the number of extreme wildfires is expected to increase by 14% by 2030 and by up to 30% by the end of 2050. According to a February report by the United Nations Environment Program, our exposure to ambient fine particulate matter, which is rising globally, is estimated to kill up to 10 million people a year. The trends in the western United States stand out because they mark a sharp change in air pollution levels. The country has some of the strongest environmental regulations in the world and has made significant progress cleaning its skies since the 1970s. Regulations such as the Clean Air Act drastically cut levels of air pollution, including lead, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen dioxide, ozone, and fine particles from vehicles, power plants, factories, and other sources. But the air quality success story has been swamped in the past decade by staggering environmental shifts due to warming climates. Beyond the spurring forest fires, climate change has also made the region more susceptible to droughts that dry out soils and expose lake beds, leading to vast plumes of airborne dust. Adding to the problem are emissions from agriculture, transportation, and fossil fuel development in California and southwestern states, which lead to high levels of ground-level ozone and other types of pollution. Some 40% of Americans, more than 137 million people, mostly in the West, are living in places that have unhealthy levels of particle pollution or ozone, according to the American Lung Association's State of Air 2022 report. The changes are putting tens of millions of people at risk, not only in Western states, but across the United States. The Clean Air Act was not designed for today's sources of pollution, says Marshall Burke, an earth system scientist at Stanford University in California. Amid all these changes, researchers are struggling to find ways to tackle the West's harmful air. dry